Yeah, welcome to the catch-up. Of course, the big news today was the London apartment building fire, and we were right across that, Ed Cavalli.
Yeah, and we spoke about the cladding on the outside of the building seems to be the major problem, and we spoke to a few knowledgeable people inside the building industry about what that stuff is and whether or not they're using it in Brisbane.
We also spoke to an eyewitness who lives a couple of streets away in an apartment block and watched as it unfolded in London.
There was one funny thing.
Well, is it possible that tomorrow we're going to turn on Channel 10 and just see the test pattern? Because that's how it feels like it's being reported, you know?
Listen, the network's absolutely fine. There's plenty going on. The people need to know that Waleed is safe.
Okay? No. I want to know. No. I want to know that have you been paying attention is going five nights a week.
Oh, Jesus, no thank you.
Wouldn't a 24-hour Simpsons station? That would be superior to Channel 10 now.
Imagine
that.
No.
That's harsh.
Yeah, no, there's some stuff
on there. All right, we'll get Waleed there for half an hour.
Yeah, he does a lecture, then an episode of The Simpsons, then another lecture, then an episode of The Simpsons.
TED Talk with Waleed.
No.
Mate. Sold out. Hey, enjoy the catch-up.
One of us here works at Channel 10. Have you been paying attention? Monday nights, 8:30. Wonderful show on Channel 10.
Appreciate that.
What's going to happen? Are you going to have to sell your Logies now that Channel 10's been put into the hands of volunteer ministers?
Mate, this is... So, as I've been saying, it's one of those funny things where business news, no one really knows anything about business news. You know, like the Adani mine and this billion-dollar deals motto that go on in construction and building, and people don't really get it. But
you've got to make
reason,
a special effort to read the business pages, but some people, there's probably a 5% of our population care about the business pages and care about what's going on. And otherwise, it ticks
reason,
over.
For some reason, this one, Robin, sort of captured people. People are asking me non-stop, what's happening with Channel 10? I'm getting text messages. Oh, no, just even people here at Triple M. Like, Oh, no, Channel 10. Guys, listen to me. It's fine.
Why? Okay, well, why is it fine? Because at the moment they're in liquidation, aren't they?
No, they're in administration. Very different things.
Oh, yeah, they're going to trade out of this. See, a lot of this is tricky business with billionaires like Murdoch and Bruce
Okay,
Gordon.
So administration means that someone else has come in over the top to do the business side of it. Is that right?
They could be doing that. But last night, Lachlan Murdoch and one of the other rich guys merged their shares together, and looks like they might be doing a bit of a controlling stake. And I would trust them, because if you've got a question about how to run a media company and you're Lachlan Murdoch, isn't it nice to just to be able to pick up the phone and go, "Hey, Dad, you know how you run the largest media company in the universe? Got any ideas for what we might do here?" But I can announce first here a number of cost-cutting measures that Channel 10 has brought in.
Okay,
people keep saying, is it going to affect any of the shows? And we keep hearing, no, you know, we've spoken to 10, no. But there have been some changes. Neighbours is moving from Ramsey Street in order to cut costs. We'll be now set on Manus Island.
Oh, nice. That's efficiency. What an episode. Event.
It's going to be quite interesting in there. Toady is the new black, it's called. Blacktown... The Blacktown vet has replaced the Bondi vet.
Oh, he's cheaper.
Yeah, he's got a catchphrase, which is, just put them all down.
What a guy.
Sounds like you.
Survivor in Samoa. This is going to have to be shot in Dubbo this year. But it's still tropical. Exactly. They just put you in Dubbo and go, there you go, good luck.
Can I throw one at you? Because everyone's going, where did it all go wrong?
Remember
the good old days?
Say it. Say the good old days.
The Simpsons. It was everyone's option to watching the news. And a lot of people went unreported, used to go, I don't like the news anymore. I'm going to watch The Simpsons. And then they went, Grant Denyer is better than Bart Simpson. They're the same size,
But well, that show goes pretty well. Family Feud goes all right. The problem is in 2011, you're right, when they moved Neighbours across to the digital channel, and people still can't find those digital channels.
That's right. I can't find them. The Simpsons and Neighbours and all that, that used to be their bread and butter. And
you
then
need
they
Bear Grylls to come round to your house to do some exploring to try and find Gem. I've never found Gem in my life. Apparently it's a channel. And they have, and so then they're going to go, so I reckon this is my prediction. They'll get what they want and they'll change some of the ownership things and they'll bring down their costs. They pay $150 million to two US companies to play their shows on Channel 10.
Like what? Like Modern Family?
But also there's something like seven or eight shows which are just in a warehouse that you can't play because they're not good enough, but they're stuck into these deals. So they'll get out of those deals. That's the first big one.
Uh-huh.
And then they might be able to try and merge a little bit with some other news services, maybe change the way sport is thing. It'll end up being actually a really good thing. They'll be able to cut a lot of dead weight.
Okay, but jobs, you reckon? The Channel 10 newsroom, everything will stay here? That's the big question.
Do we need an hour news at 5 o'clock in the afternoon?
I think that would change. I think I would imagine that would change.
Okay.
All I can say, all I say is, it's a really good news for Everybody Loves Raymond fans.
Jake and the Fat Man make a re-entry.
Jake and the Fat Man. Up next, NCIS, Wagga, and then Jake and the Fat Man. What a night.
Well, they're calling it the high-rise to hell, the towering inferno in the middle of London, and they're saying it doesn't confirm dead, but up to 70 in hospital. But the man who does know, and he's been there for the last 24 hours, is Seb Costello from Channel 9, the correspondent in London. Out the front of the building in London, Seb, what's the latest?
Marto, Robin, Ed, good morning. Guys, as we stand here, night has fallen for the first time since this fire completely destroyed Grenfell Tower, over 20 stories of public housing in the West London area. And it's such an eerie view at the moment because dozens of windows are lit up in orange. There's spot fires that have begun inside that building, which is already such a dominant part of the skyline. And to see it glowing orange against the night sky is really unnerving. Inside, these apartments are really quite large in that building. They're four-bedroom, designed for families. So there's plenty of fuel and personal belongings inside those apartments, which will be why these spot fires are still burning hours after firefighters have declared it under control.
So, Seb, I mean, what's happening with, they're saying, what, 12 dead at the moment, but there's so many others missing. Are the firefighters working the way up? Is that how they're doing it?
Well, Robin, at this point, there's no way they'd get inside that building because these fires, you know, you can see it's glowing quite a bright orange, so it's certainly not safe to get in there at the moment. They have been inside, though, and they've been able to take a preliminary look. But those figures confirmed by the fire brigade here in London are that 12 people have lost their lives at least, that over 60 were physically rescued by firefighters and that over 70 were taken to hospital, 18 of them in a critical condition. But the latest reports out of London is there are fears for dozens of lives in this situation. And guys, as we stand here, a bit of a breeze just picked up. And for anyone who's ever been at a building that has been burnt, that distinct smell, and it's so strong here, that smell of burnt material, of damp, of fire retardant, it's so strong in and around the scene.
Seb, are there families that live in there that perhaps were out or that got out? Are they sort of milling around the building? What are the authorities doing with them?
Yeah, well, Ed, there's two things that need to happen here. The first is the full investigation as to how this fire took hold so quickly. I mean, this building is not unlike things that we would have seen in Brizzy, you know, big public housing blocks. But usually, if we have fires in those buildings, you know, it's a bit of a fireball out the side, but generally firefighters are able to contain it to one apartment. The difference here is that there's something that's gone wrong for the whole building to be engulfed in the way it was. That's one side of things for authorities. The other side of things, and this is more pressing and more kind of imminent challenge, is that there's between 400 and 600 people who will never be able to live in that tower again, and we need to find temporary accommodation for them at the very least before we find a new home.
Hey Seb, I've been seeing you on Channel 9 this morning even. The exclusion zone is fairly wide. What are the engineers saying? Is there any chance those fires can melt the steel and that thing will collapse?
Well, that'll be a huge concern. Either way, Marto, this building has to come down. There's no way it'll ever be lived in again. So, you know, there are pieces that fly off, say, every hour. We see big chunks of sort of burnt cladding inside of the building that float down to street level. But, yeah, they're going to have to work out at the very least how to safely dismantle this building, which is going to be tremendously difficult because it's in the middle of a high-density public housing area. And to bring it down safely, if they do have enough time to do that before it potentially collapses, they're going to have to evacuate thousands.
Yeah, Seb Costello, Channel 9's correspondent in London. We'll see your reports all day on Channel 9. We'll speak to you soon, mate. Absolute favourites on this program for his knowledge about football and for his general. He's just a really good broadcaster, Marto, you know, and he's one of the legends of the game, Sterlo. Oh, I thought, there's nothing else I can learn about Sterlo that's it, I'm done. And then I'm reading an article the other day in Drive, and there he is standing out front of a Toyota, which is the right decision, and they asked him, they asked Sterlo about the first car that he'd ever bought, and he's on the line from Fox Sports, Sterlo on the couch. G'day, Sterlo.
Good morning, guys. How you doing?
This story's making us laugh, Sterlo. We're loving it.
Sterlo, where did you get your first car from?
Well, I was very fortunate. The great Arthur Beeson came to Parramatta and played two seasons, and he and his very good mate, Bob the Bear O'Reilly, used to like going out on the Thursday night after training.
Didn't they?
So I was basically their chauffeur. And they go to a place called the Swinging Magnum, which catered for people sort of over 35s. We called it the Fossil Disco.
Yeah,
and
man.
I used to just sit back and watch them have a good night. And then
grab
I'd
a granny night,
wherever,
was it?
Wherever they needed to go. Yeah. And my car wasn't in particularly good nick, and I sort of said at one stage that I needed to get another one, and Arthur said, well, look, I'm ready to sell mine. So I thought, well, how could you go wrong buying a car off
a legend?
Bloody beats it, yeah.
And I did. I bought his 1974 yellow Passat, which, as you can imagine, probably not the most attractive car you've ever seen.
No.
Wow.
Did he, hey, Sterlo, did he give you a warranty on it, though? Did Artie give you a warranty?
Yeah, look, he gave me a 30-day warranty, which I thought was fantastic. And it might be a little bit harsh to say, but 31 days later, it did basically just fall apart. And the thing that fell apart first was obviously the driver's seat, which had taken a fair bit of punishment over a couple of years.
He was at the heavy part of his career at that stage.
And in the end, I just saw it as a learning experience, which it was with Arthur. But, after 32 days later, I was still looking for another car because I wasn't going too far.
Stella, can I just ask you, why were you chauffeuring them around?
Well, it was Arthur and it was the Bear, and they were the greats, and they didn't want to be driving. We used to have a bit of a drink on a Thursday night after training.
That's right.
Some things have changed.
Yeah, haven't they?
So I just enjoyed being in their company, and I guess in retrospect, they were just using me up, really.
Yeah. They were, Stella.
You will learn some lessons there, because the game's won up front. So the Bear, big Bob O'Reilly and Artie, they set the platform, and Sterlo was the halfback, the young playmaker.
Yeah, that's right.
You learnt so much in that car on a Thursday night.
Yeah, a lot of things that probably I shouldn't have, and I don't know if it served me too well in later life, but it was an education.
Hey, is that where you lost all your hair, Sterlo?
No, that was just through worry. That was
through worry.
You would have had the long blonde hair in that year at that stage.
I had the flowing locks, and I hung on to them as well as I could.
All right, Sterlo, mate, we appreciate that story, man. I saw it and I thought, we got to get him on. Hey, before you jump out, Sterlo, everyone who's on the Queensland team, any of the players that we've been speaking to, they said, you know who's behind this New South Wales resurgence? It's Sterlo. He's been the one chirping away in the background. How do you think the Game 2 is going to pan out?
Oh, look, you know, we're confident, but we're also very aware and very respectful of what's a wonderful Queensland side that's going to come down here, and they're going to be desperate. It's a must-win game for them, and we know that that's how they'll approach it. But, you know, I guess the one thing that we are enjoying is the fact that we've been able to retain the same 17, so we've been able to pick up fairly comfortably from where Camp 1 was, and despite the fact we're here at the casino and been out all night playing blackjack and all of those and on a drink, and I've been shaping him around. It'll be a great contest, and we're confident, but we're certainly not overconfident, because we know we have to be a lot better than Game 1 if we're to beat Queensland.
It's only two or three nights. Someone will get arrested in the next two or three nights. Friday night, that'll be the one. You blokes will fall over.
Yeah, and look, maybe not one, might be a couple of them. Yeah. You know, we've been calling three or four up. Who knows?
Sterlo, it's always a pleasure. See you, mate.
Have a good weekend, guys.
I've got to be honest, a lot of the budget that was handed down over the last few days bored me senseless.
Good,
I know I'm supposed to be interested, but there was one thing that caught my eye, and that was about youth detention transition costs.
What?
Apparently the government are going to spend $200 million to transition. There are 49 17-year-old offenders currently in Queensland jails, and after a report was done, it was decided that they would be removed out of the adult jails and into the youth detention system.
Okay.
Are there 17-year-olds in adult jails at the moment?
Yeah, and this is my thing. Okay, I've never been to a jail, so I am just saying this purely from the experience of a mother of a 17-year-old and a lot of 17-year-olds I know, that they are clueless. And I would have thought that putting a 17-year-old, when they're not even legally able to drink or vote, into an adult system is dangerous. And I mean, as I said, I don't have any experience, and I'm sure there are a lot of people listening who do. So by all means, blow me down and tell me I'm wrong. But I just think, you know, you often say to me, Mardo, and I keep talking about it, but it's so true. Boys are stupid. And they often reckon that, you know, when you talk to psychologists and so on, they say that guys don't really transition into adulthood and men until they're in their 20s. So why would we be putting 17-year-olds in with these older guys? Like, aren't we just going, here, want to be a crim? Let me show you how.
But that's at any age you go into. It's a how-to manual. Any age you send them to jail, no matter when. If you're a 21-year-old first offender, you go to jail, you might find out more if you want to.
But I know, and you've got a 17-year-old too, I know that a lot of my vocabulary with my son is, when you're 18 and legal, you can do all that stuff. And I think that there's a transition as a parent where we talk to our children saying that, you know, 18 has been the deemed the social age that people can vote and drink and do all those kind of things. So surely that should also be the age that those kids go to jail,
but 17,
to adult jail.
17, they've left school. My bloke's 17, he's working with adults every day. So he's an adult. I'd expect if he gets in trouble, he should go to an adult jail because that's who he is. He shouldn't hang around with kids.
Ed, what do you reckon?
I reckon 16 is when...
16? No way.
Wow. 16 is that you're a kid. 17, I reckon you're an adult. They think they are. You're allowed to drive like adults.
Yeah,
your bloke can drive.
Well,
is he an adult?
No.
Or is he a kid? Well, kids shouldn't be able to drive.
He's transitioning, and therefore I think there should be a space where these guys go, because also you don't want a 17-year-old.
They're the leaders of all these rights. Are they saying, are they going to put them back with 16 and 15 and 12-year-olds, and they'll be the ringleaders showing all these 13-year-olds how to be criminals?
From what I understand, they're actually going into a transitional centre.
Have you seen some of the problems? There used to be one of these years ago at Windsor. There was a youth detention centre, and we were building just over the back fence from it. The hell that those kids, they're not angels. These kids are in youth detention for a reason. They're real bad if they're in youth detention. Keep them away from 14-year-olds, 13-year-olds.
Let's see what people think. 133-53, 17-year-olds in adult jails. Do you think this is a good idea or a bad idea? Perhaps you've got some experience of the justice system from any angle. Remember, you can always remain anonymous. Believe we may even have someone who's contacted you who's worked around this space some years ago. This could be interesting.
Court of common sense.
Yes, indeed. Before the court today, should under-18s be jailed alongside criminals over 18?
Let's call some witnesses to the stand. Mark from Arana Hills, what's your situation? What do you know?
Oh, mate, when I was 17, I went to jail 2 days after my 17th birthday, and I was housing the boys' yard, and, like, I guess that's the way it should be. Like,
hang on, explain to me. So you went to prison for how long?
Oh, about 6 months.
And you went into the adult jail?
Yeah, but you're housing the boys' yard with 17-year-olds.
Uh-huh.
With only 17-year-olds?
Yeah. Oh, there's two older blokes take on the role as mentor, but yeah, I was in the unit with 17-year-olds.
So how did you feel about being in a male prison then? Like an adult one?
I don't know. Well, I guess it's where I had to be at the time.
How'd it go for you, Mark? Did they rehabilitate? Did those older blokes mentor you in a good way?
Yes and no. I suppose they'd repay. They probably should have jails for under 25-year-olds.
Uh-huh.
Like they do in Sydney, but, you know, that's for the government.
That's what they do in Sydney, under 25-year-olds.
Do they?
Mark, can I ask you, have you ever re-offended?
Yeah, well, I did up until about 17-odd years ago.
And then you got your life back?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Thanks, Mark. It's a first-hand experience. We appreciate you calling
us. That under-25 one's an interesting call.
So from 17 to, say, 24, 25.
If you're still going to jail after 25, you've probably,
So we've got Damo from Deception Bay. Damo, what do you think about 17-year-olds being housed in adult prisons?
I think that it needs to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. There's different 17-year-olds in there with different issues, and they're there for different reasons. And if they're committing adult crimes, and they have been for some time, continue to re-offend, show no interest in becoming a productive member of society, then they should be housed in there. And to be perfectly honest with you, a lot of the sentences that are handed down to them should be longer if they're going to commit horrific crimes.
Damo, you sound like a bloke who knows.
Yeah, well, after 10 years of working in a juvenile setting and also moving over into the adult side of things. When you're listening to 16-year-olds say, when I go to jail, that's how they start a conversation.
Really?
Should they be housed with 14-year-olds?
So tell me, are there some really kind of, for want of a better word, badass 16-year-olds?
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, I can tell you stories of crimes that they committed which would make your stomach churn. Yeah, really, really, really horrific stuff. And a lot of these 17-year-olds that are in adult systems are there because that judgment's been made that I guess that they have shown nose. Like, some of them have been committing crimes since they're 9 and 10 years old.
Yeah. Then you should be jailing their parents. That's disgusting. How does that happen?
Whole family. That's a great idea.
Thanks, Damo. Appreciate that.
Yeah, nice one, Damo. Larry, what experience or what do you know, mate, in terms of being a witness in the court of common sense? What should we be doing?
I love these common sense days you have, man. I'm a copper. I've locked up plenty of people over the years. If you're 17 years of age and you're going to jail, it means that you've committed a long string of very serious offences.
You get lots of chances, don't you? Do you get lots of chances?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's no first-time offenders in jail. And I love you, Robin. You know, the nice boys that you know at that age aren't committing offences. They're certainly not committing the serious and long string of offences that have seen them go to jail.
Okay, so what about then the idea of the premise of putting people in, say, 17 to 24-year-olds, like a transition, or is that just pointless and a waste of money?
I'd say the latter, just a waste of money. They're all, you know, when you're committing offences to that degree that you go into jail, you've already
like what?
Pretty much struck yourself up as a lifer.
Like, really? Like murder?
In
like
and out are you? Can't think of any young kids of that age having committed murders. And where else are you going to be putting a murderer? Not in a different prison just because they've been 24 committing it.
Okay. No.
Larry, you know when you encounter these kids for the first time and you give them a warning, can you tell by looking in their eyes whether they've got enough fear and they won't or we will reoffend again?
No, I don't think so, particularly not in the way that you are able to deal with them nowadays. You know, kids are good actors. If they're making the decision to commit those sort of crimes that they're going to be coming before you, you know, they're skilled enough to turn on the charm or the waterworks or just flat out deny disrespectfully. They're the ones that are an obvious, you know, you're going to see them again. Mm-hmm. So much. The lack of respect, you know, that the courts have encouraged kids and adults, for that matter, to have towards police and the community nowadays is frightening.
Larry, a cop from Logan. Larry, we appreciate you calling in.
Wow.
70% of people ended up saying it depends if they're repeat offenders. If they are repeat offenders, they are under 18, they should go to jail.
Doesn't appear
to
be about the age, does it? It appears to be about the person.
Court is closed.
Yes, thank you.
That was a quick court of common sense. Rebel Wilson should have come to us. It would have been all over and sorted.
There was a silly little incident down near Isle of Capri, you know, just across from Surface, all the canals at the back there of Surface Paradise. A bloke was, I'll let the Channel 9 reporter. He was coaching some university rowing students.
Well, Melissa, the 31-year-old man was coaching a local rowing team out here on the canal this morning. He was in the support vessel when he momentarily stopped to take a phone call. Now, when he went to go restart the boat, he didn't realise it was in the wrong gear and it's bucked him out into the freezing cold water.
Okay. Are you with us so far? He's in the canal. The boat's still going. Mm-hmm. Apparently, I hope he's okay because apparently he did cut his leg slightly on the prop. And, you're with us. The boat's going round and round and you're going, right, I've got to get in this because I'm looking like an idiot. I've got the people I'm coaching here. I've got to get this sorted out. Shouldn't take long, should it?
Now, he's managed to swim to shore. In the vision, you can see him standing there completely drenched, staring out at his empty tinny as it goes round and round, painfully out of reach. Okay.
Painfully.
Oh, what do you do? He's standing on the rocks.
What does he do? What did he do?
He did it occasionally. He went for, as it went, came round once. He lunged at it and he went, here it comes. Just that bit too far.
That's a fun game to play. There was
an eyewitness there.
Tried to stop it a couple of times. It looked really dangerous. So we just wanted to get him away from it and onto shore.
Yeah, poor bloke.
So what happened? It ran out of petrol?
What happened? Yeah, what happened?
Oh, I don't know. They didn't tell us on the story.
Still going. Didn't care?
Could still be there. It's still there if you want to go down and see it.
Terrible, this image of this giant tower block completely up in flames. And we're crossing back live to London now to a gentleman by the name of Tony Gabriel, who lives just 5 minutes from the building. Hello, Tony. Thanks for speaking to us. We understand that from your house you could see the whole thing taking place.
Yes, good morning. A big tragedy, you know, since 1 a.m. From last morning. You know, the tragedy that we could, you know, that I could see and loads of all my neighbours were experiencing, you know, block of flats, you know, just in flames, started from the second floor, and the fire just literally rose to the top of the building extremely fast.
So, Tony, were you woken?
I was actually awoken of sirens, a helicopter, and, of course, when I came out to see what was happening, the worst fear that, of course, all everyone could hear was people screaming for their lives, for people, you know, to help them. People that were stuck on the top floors that couldn't get down, you know, as today has been confirmed, you know, there was loads of smoke. The staircase of the actual building was blocked with, of course, of all the smoke, you know, and I didn't actually see anything of people jumping. It's been confirmed people actually jumped, someone throwing their babies out, but you could hear the screams and, you know, just fighting for their lives, asking for people for, you know, to help. And the fire just spread it extremely, extremely quick.
Tony, how close did you get? And did you watch as the fire trucks pulled up, put their ladders up and got stuck into it?
I can't actually see from my view. I can't actually see the bottom of the flats where the fire trucks are. Yeah. So from my balcony, I see literally the whole top of the building, which is the most affected of the whole actual entire block of flats.
So can you see
and
it now,
as we're
Tony?
Talking, yes, I can see it now. And as we're talking, you can see the flames have restarted in the middle of the flats. It was a bit of control. You could see loads of smoke, but now you can actually see flames going off again.
Wow, Tony, it's just awful. And all those people that were living there, where have they gone, do you know?
Well, as a community, so we're in the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea, so it's kind of in the Notting Hill borough.
Yeah.
And the whole community have got together and we've given shelters to people. So there's leisure centres, there's churches, there's schools, accommodating these hundreds of people. The community have got together, have given bedding sheets, have given quilts, have given beds, whatever they could, food, nappies for children, and it's literally, there are places all over the borough where people are just literally going and getting what they can, and we as a community are trying to help these people, of course, you know, to do what we, you know, what we can for them.
All right, Tony Gabriel, live from London, lives just a couple of minutes from the building that went up and saw the whole thing. We appreciate your report today, Tony. Stay strong. There's not much more London can take, but it's a very brave city. It's a very strong city, and I'm sure you guys will pull together.
Yes. Yeah, we just all have to, as a community, stick together, and, you know, we just kind of, you know, hope, you know, it doesn't get any worse. You know, as you guys are probably here now, the biggest fear is, you know, of course, of the building collapsing. You know, and, you know, we're just kind of praying, you know, for all those people, you know, that are missing and that are in hospital with, you know, quick recoveries. And, you know, we're just kind of all praying for all those families that have, you know, have lost, you know, members of their families or are missing, you know, in this tragic,
Tony,
you know, accident.
Thanks for talking to us today, mate. See you later. Thank you.
Looking for Brisbane's problem traffic spots. What screws up your area?
Well, we were talking about yesterday at the Gateway, Ed, and that truck that blocked both ways for many hours, and then it just went throughout the day. Then that motorcycle came through and apparently skidded on the diesel that was still on the road.
It was fairly treacherous yesterday. It was really slippery, and those places where, like, if you come off the Toowong roundabout and you're coming onto Milton Road, the back end of cars were giving way.
Oh.
But, you know, so there were lots of accidents going on. But we want to know locally in your area where if something goes wrong.
We're screwing up areas. You've just called Wynnum Road. You're trapped down there at Bulimba Hawthorne, those people.
Well, there's all these signs along houses saying there's a better way to spend $50 million because obviously they're wanting to widen that road and it's backing on all those beautiful, expensive houses back onto the river. And they're the ones that may have to go. But if you are servicing out down to Wynnum or even Bulimba and Hawthorne, that's the only way in and out. If you're going to Churchy School, you've got to go down there and then turn right into that main traffic. Yeah. Anyway, that's just my observation.
Everyone's got
yesterday.
Their own angle on this, though. Who's that, Ed?
This is Craig from Caboolture. All right, Craig, in Caboolture, what is it in your area, mate? What stuffs it up?
Well, apparently, as I was saying before, that I'm one of the few people in Caboolture that work, apparently.
Well done, you, Craig.
Is it you, Craig?
So, absolutely. So once you get to once you get past Anzac Avenue heading north, or sorry, heading south, there's no exit if something goes wrong. So you're stuck in Brackenridge Road until Brackenridge Road. You can't go Gympie Arteria. You can't go anywhere.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you are trapped. If there's like a problem like yesterday, if you've gone too far, if you went past the fork there after the Pine Rivers, you're stuffed.
It's all over. It took me 2.5 hours to get home from Eagle Farm yesterday, so.
Ooh. 2.5, Craig.
Oh, you're winning, my
still
friend.
Sound happy, Craig. You've got good attitude.
Yeah, you can't get angry anymore about it because we've become more like Sydney.
Gary of Murray, you're a truckie, so you would see lots of stuff. What would you like to say?
We see way too much of it. I've driven in Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide in peak hour, even Los Angeles in peak hour, but Brisbane is just unbelievable. I don't know how people in Brisbane put up with it, having to drive to and from work, especially on the Gateway. The Gateway from about 2 p.m. onwards is just a car park.
Mate, can I ask, like they always say Sydney's such a basket case because of the harbour and trying to get over and around it. Is our river just as bad?
I think probably worse. In Sydney, they're building roads, they're building tunnels that cater for all the traffic. Brisbane's got fantastic roads, don't get me wrong. There's just too many people trying to use them. They've got a...
That's true, my suggestion... That's true, yeah.
Yeah, it is. This Gateway motorway is probably the best motorway in Australia until one little wheel falls off and then it just goes...
That's what it's about.
Just, everything goes apart. What I think someone should be putting to the Premier is to do what the US does. Instead of this trying to clear extra land and make these roads wider, go up one floor.
I'll go over the top.
Multi-level. Interesting, Gary. Thank you, Scotty. Do that
in China and Japan
and
stuff?
That would be so weird.
It works, though. A lot of places do it. Scotty's from Kenmore. Scotty, in and around your travels and in your area, what stuffs it up?
Mate, I drive from Redbank to Kenmore every day and the Centenary Highway.
Oh, I'm with you. That Jindalee Bridge, slowing down around the DFO there. Shocking.
Yeah, but, it's not the problem is people can't merge.
Yes.
Well, there's that too.
I keep hearing that Brisbane people are the worst in Australia at merging. We must be.
They are terrible. And you had a subject on the other day about how the courtesy wave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know.
It doesn't happen. And you know that. I don't get annoyed. I'm pretty chilled. But, hey, you could at least say thank you.
Yeah.
Fair enough, Scotty.
See you, Scotty. Well Thanks, done. Mate.
Everyone That's take good. Scotty's advice.
Liz from Redcliffe. Liz, what is it around your way?
So I actually travel in from Caboolture. Yes, I work in Caboolture as well.
well played.
I travel from Caboolture into Redcliffe every day. And as soon as the Gateway Motorway or Gympie Road goes down, everyone then funnels in through North Lakes. Mm. And I go down Dee Bay Road and then it's shocking. Like, you can't get into Redcliffe because everyone tries to bypass the Gateway through Redcliffe and the roads just can't handle it.
Gosh.
How often does that happen, Liz?
More often than you would think. Like last year, actually, there was an accident on the Ted Smart Bridge and a bikey, I think he passed away on the exit at North Lakes. It took me 2.5 hours to get from Caboolture to Redcliffe.
But you, the thing is, Liz, you've actually got it a lot easier than some people who are going Caboolture all the way to the other side of town too.
Yeah.
You've actually nailed it, just ain't going to Redcliffe.
Hey, thank you, Liz. Let's go to Terry from Tanimura. Terry, and are you calling us live from the M1 at the moment?
I'm calling you from what was the M1 car park. We are now moving at about 30k an hour.
Oh, wow.
Is that good? Is that good for this time in the morning?
So, Terry, do you pull on at Tanimura? You get onto the M1 there near the Logan Hyperdome, and every day that would be almost ground to a halt, yeah?
Every day. I can expect my minimum drive is 1 hour, but if I was to do that on a weekend, I'd do it in 20 minutes.
So, Terry, is it worth it for you?
Yes, I love my job.
Bob of Zilmia, you got a solution? What is it?
I ride a motorbike. It just feels great. There's just big masses of traffic. You just go straight to pole position every time, and all you suckers are stuck in the traffic. It's just, if it's not raining, I ride my motorbike. It's great.
I know, it's tough yesterday. You know how much people hate you, Bob?
I don't care.
Mind you, though, Bob, yesterday there was lots of criticisms that bikes were taking out at people's mirrors.
Some people are aggressive. They can't stand you going past them, and they'll move over so they can't get by, but I just go really slow. My motorbike makes lots of noise. You just rev it so they can hear you coming and sort of, yeah, it's good.
Bob, are you telling me that some people try to slide over and maybe give you a little nudge?
There's people like that. There's lots of a-holes out there.
Fair enough.
Well said, Bob.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, everybody. Bob. This apartment building had just gone just had a £10 million refurbishment in 2016, and part of that was what they were calling rainproof cladding motto over the top of a concrete building with some aluminium cladding.
Yeah.
And they're saying that that may have been one of the cause for the fire spreading so rapidly. Robin, we spoke to someone earlier today.
Yeah, his name is Tony Gabriel. He lived just down the road and he was explaining what he could see.
It's been confirmed people actually jumped, someone throwing their babies out, but you could hear the screams and, you know, just fighting for their lives, asking for people for, you know, to help.
The speed of the fire was what we keep hearing, how quickly it spread, and now they're saying it was all about the cladding that was recently, you said £10 million they spent on it. We've got Gordon on the line, and Gordon, you know something about this cladding, is that correct? You're a retired air traffic controller.
Yes, good morning. Yeah. I was in the Air Force for a number of years, and during that time I was a base fire officer at a couple of bases, so a little bit of knowledge about fire and things that go woof. I travelled to Dubai a few times in recent years, and I have friends who live there, and the buildings in Dubai are sadly, and anybody can Google this, are going up with monotonous regularity because the cladding to make the building look good on the outside is apparently something akin to the aluminium foam sandwich that you would use to make a cold room or a large walk-in freezer.
Oh, okay. So there's insulation behind the aluminium face on it.
Yeah, it's like a sandwich. And, okay, if the sandwich is not heated or broken, then I suppose it might be okay for a little while. But as soon as it's exposed to fire, then it's completely flammable. It's melted plastic. Gosh. And when I was in Dubai last time, there's a very flash building where this whole facade melted, and you can see the molten plastic at the base of the building around the swimming pool and the terrace. But they've covered the entire, when I was there, they covered the entire front of the building with Hessian so people couldn't see it, couldn't look at it.
Because no panic.
Well, in this building case, for instance, the fire from the cladding did not make it inside the apartments or inside the offices.
Okay, it just burnt the outside little shell.
It burnt the outside, but it went straight up the front of the building all the way to the top.
Like a wick.
Now, somebody, somewhere, is going to pay for all of this. There's got to be some people sent to jail because hiding behind legislation, there was no legislation to make it this, or it wasn't in the specification for the building, what have you. The people that did that refurbishment on the building in London must, if it's recent, must have known about what was going on in Dubai. It's worldwide news. Mm. And if they've used this material on the front, then somebody's criminally responsible.
Jesus. Well, whoa. If you're able to know this, if they're saying that there's buildings like this in Sydney and Melbourne have got the same stuff, this will take off today, I would reckon, this story.
Residential houses all over the Gold Coast where I live have this foam stuff as architectural features over windows and on the side of the building to make a cheap feature instead of building it out in steel and putting some kind of fireproof stuff on. It's actually this foam stuff.
There's that word, Gordon. There's that word, cheap. When you put the words cheap and construction together, Marto, I'm not an expert, but to me that doesn't seem like a very good idea. Gordon, thanks so much for your insights today. The Daily Mail is reporting that the company that paid £11 million to manage the flats is being accused of incompetence, as the boss who oversaw the £10 million revamp admits he doesn't know what the building's clad in.